Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Have you ever wondered what some body movements mean when people hear certain words or see certain images? Many of these body movements are involuntary reactions inherent to the individual and/or culturally based. I can read you like a book, How to Spot the Messages and Emotions People Are Really Sending with Their Body Language, is a book by Gregory Hartley and Marianne Carinch. It describes methods of understanding what people really mean and how to gain insight into their background by watching their physical behavior when they listen to words or see certain things. Hartley, a former Army interrogator, details how to review with an open mind what you see, how to know what is relevant, and how to analyze and identify involuntary versus voluntary movements, and then how to decide or draw a conclusion based on what you have just observed. When I spoke with Greg Hartley from his home near Atlanta, Georgia, in early April 2007, we started our conversation by discussing how to review, evaluate, analyze, and interpret what may be observed when watching another person.
Yeah, I came up with an acronym to make it easier for people to learn this skill set, and it's READ, R-E-A-D, that being review, and I ask people to turn off their thinking brain that understands what everything means, and to overlay that, or to replace that childlike brain they had at 2 and 3 years old, and just to look. Don't jump to conclusions about what anything means, just take in data. Then the E piece is evaluate. The evaluate piece is nothing more than saying, which piece of this body language means something? Which is out of the norm? Which stands out? Which is different? Then the analyze piece is where you take your life skill set and overlay those pieces onto it so that you can better understand how it all goes into context. And then D is, how will I use it? D is about internalizing what you've seen and deciding how to move ahead.
Can you give us some examples of using the READ, review, evaluate, analyze, and decide methodology?
Yeah. For instance, if you were to have learned body language 50 years ago, you'd have been told, and most of us were in high school psychology, that crossing your arms is closing your body, and it means that you're closing someone out. Well, that's skewed thinking because every person is different. So I would say open your eyes and look for things. And I give 4 pieces of body language to look at that are pretty commonly used in the body language analysis part of the world. And that is the illustrator, which is nothing more than my brain emphasizing what I'm thinking as I speak, you know, batoning with your hands, gesturing with your hands, using your eyebrows, that kind of thing. Adapters, which are nothing more than releasing nervous energy. Maybe it's pacing. Maybe it's rubbing the ear, maybe it's twirling the hair. We look for those. Manipulators or regulators, depending on who you ask, as a way to control the conversation. So, for instance, holding up my hand as if to say, wait a minute. And then barriers, being the piece that is crossing my arms, rubbing my hands in front of me, putting a physical barrier between us. Looking at each of those, you have to take into account the person you're looking at. Men, for instance, will have one kind of behavior, women another. And if something is not typical for a person of that gender, you know, you still have to take into account the individual. So I look every day at the individual, start from the ground up, look at what's comfortable, look at what changes as I start the conversation. Now I've picked out what is different. So, for instance, if the person suddenly crosses their arms or suddenly crosses their legs, then I would enlarge that. I would pull that out, evaluate, and say that's the most important piece. I would analyze based on their gender, on the situation we're in, on what they were responding to as far as stimulus, to try to decide what it meant, and then I would decide what to do with it. So in my case, if I see I'm asking someone a question casually, and their conversation is normally about the same cadence, and suddenly they slow to a cadence more like this, I notice their eyes drop down into the left and their hands come up in front of them, I would quickly assume that there's calculation going on as to how to answer the question, and that they're burying me out for some reason, and then I would start to dig for the reason.
How would you start to dig for the reason?
What I'd do is I would start to probe around all of the outlying areas. All conversations have ancillary topics running on the outside of the conversation. I'd start to probe around those to try to relax the person to see if, in fact, there was stress associated with a specific issue. And if, in fact, they relaxed as I took them off the topic, but as I came back to the topic, I found the stress increased and their adapters increased, for instance. They played with their ears a little more. They fidgeted their fingers a little more. They paced a little more. I would know that's the topic, and I would just continue to question around the edges or casually talk around the edges to find out the magnitude of the problem and try to figure out, you know, to compartmentalize what the problem is.
Greg Hartley, in your professional background, you work as an interrogator for the military and for police agencies. So it sounds like what you're doing fits into those examples.
It does in daily life, though. You'd be surprised if in your conversations with someone today, you'll notice stress around topics. If you're overly aggressive with your questioning style, then it does sound like a police interrogation, but I can casually carry on conversation with someone and notice where their stress areas are, primarily because my eyes are more attuned to seeing changes. But everyone has the skill set. Most of us have an instinct for being able to tell when someone's uncomfortable with a subject. And all I'm teaching you to do is to put a set of skills with that so that you can open your eyes and see specific pieces of body language that indicate that stress.
It seems what you're looking at is the initial review. You talk about turn off the thinking brain.
Yep. We all have this capability when we're born. Children, if you remember every two-year-old you've ever met, children look and say, why, because they're building a brain. Then sometime around 14, we start to get all of our sex hormones that change who we are. We stop using that thinking brain. We start to say, well, I know better. And with some of us, it comes back. With some of us, it stays gone for the rest of our lives, and we assume that what we know is right. What I ask people to do is to go back to that two-year-old brain and just look at what you see. That's the beginning stage, because if you have any idea that this means X or that means Y, you'll project that meaning onto the person.
Can you give us an example?
Yeah, the number one example is the old crossing the arms. The number two example is, and my favorite, most Americans will tell you they can tell when someone's lying. And when I ask how, every one of them says they don't make eye contact. Interestingly enough, when you start to think, your eyes will drift. And I can give you an example of that. When I ask this question, pay attention to your own eyes as you try to answer the question. Most people's eyes are going to drift slightly up and to their left. The question is, what is the fifth word of the Star Spangled Banner?
Say that question again.
What is the fifth word of the Star Spangled Banner?
Okay.
Yeah. You catch your eyes drifting up and left. Well, in human brains, our sound processors are directly over our ears, and they're called temporal lobes. It's where we store sounds. In 90% of the population, the eyes will drift to the left temporal lobe. In 10%, it will drift to the right temporal lobe. And you have to ask a question you know the answer to, and I often use this in training. I use exactly what I just used with you, a contrived question. But you can ask a casual question you know the answer to that is more natural and less contrived and get the same response. Then when I ask you a question about a conversation and your eyes deviate from that memory spot to the other temporal lobe, it's a good indicator you're deceiving me. Well, the only reason that's important is a long answer to a short question. The only reason that's important is because if 90% of the population thinks that eye contact means you're telling the truth, they're deluding themselves, because if you ask a complex question, the person has to remember they're going to break eye contact. If a person's rehearsed an answer, they're going to make solid eye contact to try to convince you.
So in other words, you get a baseline by what is the fifth word of the Star Spangled Banner and watch what the eyes do, and then you probe into the topic areas in which you're inquiring.
Exactly. Very much like a polygraph. We're just using single channel. And as I tell people all the time, I have many more channels going than a polygraph eventually, because I listen to things like voice tone. I look for things like, you know, fidgets, adapters, those kinds of things, breathing rate, cadence of voice, all of that if I'm looking for a lie. But more importantly, I'm looking for a lie. There's so much that the body is telling you about what the person's thinking. You don't have to find a lie. You can find stress. And the stress is the number one indicator of a lie.
Where do you see the stress?
Well, it varies from person to person. usually adapters will increase dramatically, and by that I mean the fidgets and playing with nails and twirling hair. If a person is a highly agitated person or very fidgety to start with, that will usually slow as their brain starts to engage to try to think of how to get out of the problem. So we look for deviations in baseline, not to say that any specific thing means X or Y. The other thing that's interesting is because the human brain is designed to turn off in high fight or flight, as someone gets under more stress, they'll stop thinking. Their frontal lobe will turn off and they'll go to the limbic thought system. So in effect, what they're doing when they get into the limbic system is just trying to survive. What we find when that happens is all the signs of fight or flight are there. So you get pale skin as the blood leaves the face and goes to the muscles. You get dilated pupils as the body starts to try to take in more data about the threat. Elevated respiration, which then results in cold sweat and that kind of thing. So that's the heightened sense of fight or flight that results, you know, from stress. But in the short term, it's usually smaller things like nervous tics increase. Barrier ring may increase. A person may put something between you and them. A person may illustrate more dramatically, meaning their hands may whip you into submission for not believing what they're saying because they're stressed. If you think about the most famous lie in history with Bill Clinton, I did not have sexual relations with that woman, he actually held his hand as if he were holding a riding crop and whipping you with it. And it changed forever the way most American politicians illustrate, because now they all put their thumb against their index finger curled and use that to illustrate instead of their finger, because they've been taught batoning is bad.
Here today, we're in radio. Can you talk about voice and how the voice represents what the body is doing?
You know, it's interesting because aside from physical exertion, obviously the body has some other impact on the voice. I say always that gesturing is the servant of the mind, meaning when the mind is trying to make a point, it's going to gesture to emphasize certain things. So that's the whole illustrator piece. I say that verbal choice or diction is the choice of the will, meaning I make my decision what I'm going to say, and I can very carefully select words. And I say that the vocal portion of the spoken language is the servant of the highest bidder. If, in fact, there's a whole lot of stress in the person as they're trying to make a point, the voice is going to change. So you'll hear the pinched kind of vocals, or the rushed cadence, or change in pitch. And if you remember in the 1980s, there was a guy named John Lovitz who made a great career off nothing more than a stupid little Saturday Night Live skit where he just went, yeah, my wife, Morgan Fairchild. You remember that one? It's because we know that people's voices rise when they're under high stress.
How about interrupting in an interview, for perhaps a telephone interview, where questions are being asked, and before they can be completed, the person being questioned provides what he or she thinks is the answer?
Well, I think that's human nature. Our very nature is to rush to answer because we're trying to accommodate, or in some cases, depending on the situation, the person may be trying to control the conversation and ensure you don't ask a damaging question. Depending on, you have to read that individually, of course, and you listen for stress versus more casual kind of a conversation style. I typically think the person who's answering in a casual conversation style is assuming they understand what you're saying, whereas if they have more of a stressed sound to their voice, I would think they're trying to circumvent a dangerous question.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Greg Hartley, who, along with Marianne Corinch, wrote a book, I Can Read You Like a Book, How to Spot the Messages and Emotions People Are Really Sending with Their Body Language. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Greg, let's talk about how culture fits into body language behavior.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Culture is probably, I call it the big outside influence. If you look at everything from microculture, meaning a relationship between two people, I call that a microculture, all the way up through superculture, which arguably the United States is a superculture because we're so ubiquitous in advertising in that, then everything is going to have layers of influence. If you look at people who live in, I always am amused to watch TV from very isolated tribes in developing countries where they're wearing American clothing or rugby shirts and that kind of thing. There's no way to get away from that influence, because if a person wears a different kind of clothing, it impacts their body language. I spent a good portion of my life traveling in the Middle East, and living with people who would sit on the floor to eat. That changes their body language. That changes the way they sit and they gesture and all of those things. But more importantly, in a culture like ours, where we constantly struggle to become, as I refer to it in the book, supertypical, where we struggle to become celebrity, the celebrities have a huge impact on the way we behave and what's acceptable in American society, to the point that they can move our body language and our behavior and our dress code and all those things quickly, much more quickly than they could have, you know, in our grandparents' generation. So all of those cultural nuances change dramatically, and you can get left outside, and then that's perceived as, you know, subtypical. We try to emulate the people who are the cool people in our society, and that has its impact.
Can you give us an example of a cool person who is emulated?
Well, I say all the time, just from a style or fashion point of view, if, you know, insert celebrity here, were to cut her hair with a broken bottle, the next day if you walk the streets of Manhattan, you'd find people with that same haircut. That's just a style example. But mannerisms, if you look around you at how many hip-hop artists have impacted young kids and their mannerisms and their behavior, it's amazing how that has permeated our culture, because it is the cool thing for today. Now, there are other things. For example, if you were to give a thumbs up, that's considered a very American thing. But the world knows about it, and it does have an impact in other places. Doesn't mean they truly think it's the same thing we do. They've just modeled it after Americans to let us know that they know who we are, that kind of thing. When I travel the Middle East, you'd see the thumbs up. It's not at all a Middle Eastern thing. I have read that okay is the most recognized phrase in the entire world.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Let's talk about rites of passage, because they have a significant effect in cultural development, such that they develop a memory that eventually becomes involuntary.
Yeah, and I think when we talk about rites of passage, I try to lump that to some degree in short with rituals of any kind, because everything you do impacts the rest of your life. We get so involved in what we do ritualistically that we don't even realize it. In the 80s, when there was a huge rise in terrorism in Northern Ireland, there were plenty of people who were kneecapped, you know, shot in the kneecaps, for being Catholic in a place where there were, it was high Protestant content. And I often wondered, how do you know someone's Catholic? How can you tell? Apparently, there are mannerisms that they pick up, and they could pick them out, even if you were not from the same area. So if that's true, think of things like ritualistic scarring, things like, you know, female circumcision, any of those things that occur in other parts of the world that we are not privy to, that we don't understand, how much impact does that have on their body language on a daily basis? How much impact does it have on the way they walk, the way they behave? I will tell you that having spent most of my life in the military, I have a very military posture and a very military strut, if you will, you know, that kind of a walk, that kind of movement that is extremely different from someone who's never spent time in the military. Everything we do as a rite of passage impacts who we are for the rest of our lives.
In doing so, even the ritual of brushing teeth develops a residual memory and a muscle memory and an involuntary form of behavior.
You know, it's interesting. I go, brushing teeth is a good example. How many things do you do on a daily basis that you have no concept of how you do? You just do them. It's actually part of your life to the degree that you have no concept you're even doing it. I ask often, describe to me walking from your bedroom and getting to work. Give me every step of the way. And I usually hear, I get in the car, I turn the key. You know, there are a lot of pieces that you forget along the way. And our brains are these complex operating systems with many, many applications running, many subroutines that we don't even realize. And what, if anything, that I do is magical of any kind, it's nothing more than opening my eyes and paying attention to all the subroutines people do on a daily basis they're not aware of. In brushing your teeth, for example, tying your shoes. Do you know which shoe you tie first? Do you know which sock you put on? I'll guarantee you there's a ritual to it. But most people just don't realize it.
And then in the area of involuntary actions, we see that in driving an automobile.
More importantly is our daily life and relationships in our daily life. For instance, if you're involved with someone and prior to every argument, there's a certain piece of body language that goes along with that in your spouse or your mate, the next time you see that, you'll have the same response. So, for instance, it's what I call baggage always. When someone splits up in a from a relationship and gets involved in another one, and the person has a behavior that is similar to the last person, it automatically cues a behavior in you. So it's very dangerous to relationships. Most of who we are is ritualistic. We eat a certain way, we cut our food a certain way, we pick up our fork a certain way. Everything we do in our life is so routine that I think most of us would be surprised if we watch video over and over and over of us doing this thing.
So then let's take this back to where we began in terms of body language, being able to observe the routine. You gave us the example of what is the fifth word of the Star Spangled Banner.
Right.
And you watch the way the eyes move. That takes us into one routine.
Yep, I look for everything. I look for everything from, and as I said, I give you the big four: illustrators, adapters, manipulators, and barriers. I look for every one of those things. Eye movement's just the easiest for me to teach people usually on the radio. But if you look at everything a person does, I start from head to toe. People do not choose their clothes by accident. And I often tell people, look at what someone's wearing. It's sending a message, whether it's a message of, I really don't care, or it's a message of, I've picked, you know, this pair of shoes that cost more than your car, is not the important piece. It's that they made a conscious decision. And I look at that to try to build a holistic picture. I also look at things like energy, direction, and focus of the person to get a better idea where their head's at. Because, for instance, if a person is high energy and all of their focus is internal and they seem scattered, I count that as distraction. I have a table for determining where energy is going and helping you to understand the person. I look at barriering because as a person gets less and less comfortable, they will cover themselves in some way. And you think of the traditional male in front of a camera for the first time, or a guy who's standing in front of a crowd for the first time, covers his hands in front of his groin. That's called a fig leaf, and it's a number one protective posture for men. Women have their own version. I look for things like adapters, where the person is constantly fidgeting or pacing. The person is playing with their ears. Typically, a male adapter is very tactile, rubbing more difficult, you know, more hard than laying his hand along the side of his neck or something. A woman will more typically pat her neck, stroke her hair, tilt her head. So I look for those behaviors that are indicative of stress release. I look for illustrators. I look for the brain to punctuate the words a person's saying. If I see a deviation between the punctuation and the sentence, I start to look for reason.
How about clothing? Bright clothing versus clothing that's not bright.
You know, there's been a lot said that introverts wear a certain color, extroverts wear a certain color. I don't find that to be true. I think it's just a personal style thing. I've known some extremely introverted people who like bright colors. It was their expression and that kind of thing. I find that color, a lot of it has to do with a personal sense of style. You know, if a person really thinks that outlandish is good, you'll see them in something crazy. Some people, it's what you identify with. Again, it goes to rites of passage, ritual, behavior. Who do we identify with and who are we trying to be like?
Well, Greg Hartley, author of I Can Read You Like a Book, you've talked about how you observe what other people do, but I suspect that you've also observed in yourself, why do you do what you do? And how would you answer that question?
You know, it's interesting. I would say it started, of course, as a child. There's certain behaviors your parents taught you. I say the first one we ever learn is no. Your parents don't say yes to you. They don't look at you and say yes, yes, yes. Your parents say no, 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 and you adapt to that. So that's the first thing you ever learn, and I know that has some foundation in who I am. Everything I look at, everything I do, some of it comes from sheer biology. I mean, I look at my father every day. I'm 45 now. Look at my father every day and see where I'm going, because some of it's biology. Some of my movement patterns and that are his. How I sleep, all of those things are his. And then on top of that, add everything you ever went through. You know, I'm a redhead. That gives you a certain amount of behavioral baggage, I'm sure, as a child. You know, redheads go through certain things, so that has an impact. And then I'm a soldier. I spent most of my life in the military, so my movement patterns today are restricted more than they would have been had I not spent most of my life marching in that. Then I was married and divorced. That has its own place. That impacts how you think and how you behave in relationships. I'm in a good, productive relationship now. That has an impact. So what I've learned is that every day, if you are healthy, every day is a growing experience, and something's changing in you every day. And looking to know what impact it's having on your body language is always interesting. Aging has its own impact.
Well, Greg Hartley, author of I Can Read You Like a Book, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Yeah, I've read, or am reading, Without Conscience by Robert Hare, and it's a book about psychopaths, primarily because I'm interested not only in their body language, but what's going on inside their heads, because they have such a shallow depth of emotion.
Where do you find that shallowness?
Well, I often say with interrogation, we appeal to three emotions, and this is not really covered in this book, it was covered in the first book, but we appeal to love, hate, and greed, the three primary emotions people have to try to get them to do something. It's not abuse, it's usually just appealing to those primary emotions. And from what my understanding of psychopaths is that today, in reading his book and in some discussions with psychologists, they have greed down pat, and it's not even greed, it's self-centeredness. But what they don't have is a real depth of emotion in love and hate. They don't have the concept of understanding that other people have feelings. They have no empathy for other people.
When you mentioned the first book, that's your book, How to Spot a Liar?
Right, How to Spot a Liar. And How to Spot a Liar is more about, you know, books, titles can sometimes be a little bit misleading. That one is about liars, but it's about a process for getting through to a liar. So, as I've told people before, you could have a subtitle called, or Things I Learned from Interrogating Bad Guys, whatever you want to call it. It's a lot to do with human behavior, why we do what we do, the effects of stress on the brain, the long-term impact on the psyche, those kinds of things.
Well, Greg Hartley, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. Greg Hartley and Marianne Carinch are the authors of I Can Read You Like a Book, How to Spot the Messages and Emotions People Are Really Sending with Their Body Language. The book Greg Hartley recommends is Without Conscience, The Disturbing World of Psychopaths Among Us by Dr. Robert D. Hare. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.